Hello and welcome to the In the Money Players Podcast. I'm your host, Peter Thomas Fornital. This is our show for Tuesday, May 4th. Remember when I used to say the show numbers? We then had so many shows that I couldn't say the show numbers anymore. If I were to guess, though, this is approximately show 742. I don't know. That's a good over-under. I don't know which way it goes. Anyway, I'm here. I'm in the bunker. And I'm being joined by a player who did such a fantastic job on our Pro Players Roundtable. Gotten as many compliments on that show, really, as anything we did during this Derby season. And this Derby season was so busy, that means as many compliments as any show ever. I'm speaking about Pro Player Sean Borman. Sean, how are you today?
Doing good, Pete. How are you?
Life is good. How did you end up making out on the weekend? This is the perfect example of that conversations I want to have with people anyway. We haven't even spoken properly to get into all the nitty gritty. How'd you end up?
I had a winning weekend. Nothing huge, but a nice winning weekend.
That's good. Winning weekends are what we like to hear. You know, I barely was able to bail out the boat, as I explained to JK, but we'll get there. We'll get to the Derby. We're probably not going to go that deep into the Derby because there's so much else to talk about. JK and I went through the Derby at great length in a show yesterday. You could also check that out on our YouTube channel. And we encourage everybody listening to do us a favor and subscribe and follow us along on YouTube as well. Going to be more YouTube content, more YouTube-only content, too, coming up on there in the near future. But we're here today to talk about the stakes races from Oaks and Derby Day. We'll go all the way back to race number 6 on Friday, April 30th, where Maxfield made his return to the race as a winning one, set off at 2-5 and looked like a pretty easy winner, running out in a 1:22 time form U.S. Figure. Actually, the raw speed figure for that was 1:24. So a little better on the raw speed figure, I guess downgraded a little bit because of the pace. I'm curious, Sean. So Maxfield ships out west and disappoints, a race where a lot of us were against him, comes back here in a spot where many of us thought he couldn't lose. Going forward, how good do we think this horse is? Is this a serious contender for a race like the Breeders' Cup Classic?
That's a really good question. I would say off his race Friday, you'd have to think yes. You know, I think that was pretty impressive, and he won the way a nice horse should win. You know, my only question is his bad race was at 10 furlongs. So for the Classic, you just don't know yet, I guess. But based off what we saw Friday, I'd assume he's very live.
One interesting thing to note on the time form figures is it actually doesn't have the Santa Anita Derby as a bad race. It has it as a fast race. On their figures, he had a 1:23 in there with the winner Idol getting a 1:26. Offhand, how did you – I know I'm not sure where you are in your figure-making process for this weekend, but how much did you have the Santa Anita handicap as a backup for him heading into that day?
I had him, I believe we talked about this on the Pro Players Pod. I had him about 8 points lower in the Santa Anita Derby, or in the Santa Anita race, sorry, than I did prior to that. And just sort of eyeballing things right now, I would say he to on my figures, he's going to run back to that race in the mineshaft figure-wise. A low to mid hundred. So, you know, I don't know what happened in Santa Anita, and maybe my figure could be wrong.
I would say visually and based on some other figures I've seen, they match what you had as opposed to the time form scale. But, you know, that's one of the things that's interesting about figures sometimes is just that ability to note where people have differences and similarities. I'm not sure how much it matters now with this race as his established level of current form. Be interesting to see where he goes from there, if this is going to be a Saratoga horse potentially for Brendan Walsh, or if they might get very ambitious with a race like the Met Mile. Time, I haven't heard anything. Time will tell. But it sounds like you sound to me like you're just going to, you know, evaluate him based on the specifics of that race and don't really have a strong opinion one way or the other going forward, taking a wait-and-see approach.
Yeah, I would say that's right. You know, one thing I will say about the Santa Anita race is that was, as Paul mentioned, that was his first race with no Lasix. And he came back pretty quick in like 3 weeks to get there. So he shipped out there, had, you know, new medication situation and was back fairly quick. So he very well could have just thrown a dud that day and then come back to himself on Friday. So it'll be interesting to see how he progresses next time out.
No doubt about it. Let's move on to race number 7, the Grade 2 Edgewood, won by Gift List for Brian Lynch, and Javier Castellano came back in a respectable 110 time form USA speed figure. But I would imagine the story of this race was the one who didn't show up, Aunt Pearl. They are saying, and this matches the visual impression, that she bled under pressure there. Maybe another interesting thing to talk about is how the turf, what you felt like the turf course was playing. It's listed as good here in the chart of the Edgewood. You'd think that would have played into the hands of Aunt Pearl. What did you think of the Edgewood in general?
You know, I'm sure Aunt Pearl did bleed, but she was terrible. And I thought there was one horse that could beat her if she didn't fire, and that was Giftless. So, you know, that actually worked out for me personally, as I used Giftless as a backup and some picks and hit the pick five okay that day because of that. But, you know, the one thing I would say about Aunt Pearl, and here I am on this broken record late pace thing again, you know, she was a very short priced horse that had yet to run par level late pace figures for a Grade 2 stakes race as a 3-year-old filly. So, you know, those horses just, they can get beat, and they can get beat at very short prices. And it's typically because they encounter some kind of adversity in the race and just don't have the talent to overcome it. Now, I'm not saying that bleeding is necessarily adversity, but that's just a point. That's just a wagering point that I think people need to be aware of, is to bet a horse at 1-5 and to put all your money in a pick sequence on a horse at 1-5, they need to be dead solid. And in my mind, she wasn't exactly that.
You make a fair point. I was excusing that fact coming in, the idea behind it being what Paul Matisse has talked about in various arenas about this crop of horses coming through these graded stakes races without Lasix have generally put up slower figures. So I wasn't as much worried about the historical par for a runner like Aunt Pearl. What do you think about that general observation, though? Are your figures capturing what Paul's figures are capturing, that this crop of 3-year-olds is running a bit slower? And do you think that's the quality of the group? Do you think that hypothesis about the Lasix has something to do with it? What's your read on that whole debate?
It's just a really interesting thing. I just don't know. You know, I'm not smart enough or well versed enough in Lasix and its ability to improve performance or not, to really know what these horses should be running off Lasix. You know, when I look at these, you know, I like to look at the full pace lines of horses, as everybody's probably figured out by now. And, you know, when I look at especially the males, you know, the 3-year-old males this year, you know, like we discussed leading into the Derby, none of them were that great to begin with. And, you know, I just don't know if it's the Lasix or if it's just the crop. I guess we'll find out in the future, but I don't have a good answer. You know, I'm just relying on, you know, data points in my figures and in my, you know, brain that I've used in the past successfully. And one of them is when horses are short prices, they better be real solid on my stuff. And Aunt Pearl wasn't, for whatever reason.
No, that makes sense. I wonder about the Lasix thing. I'm at a point now where I'm ready to start factoring it in when some of these stakes runners go back to where they can run on Lasix. I think I'm ready to build in a little bit of room for improvement when I'm trying to evaluate their ability. Maybe it's premature, but sometimes you have to make a call like that prematurely, because if you wait till you have all the evidence, then any edge that you might have gleaned from it is gone. So that's where my brain is. Curious to see if you think that is a mistake or a smart way to fly.
No, I think that makes plenty of sense. And, you know, this time of year with this age of horse, you're sort of building in improvement along the, you know, as the summer goes on anyway. So
true.
you know, that's just sort of a natural part of horses developing. I don't know, you know, if they typically improve 6 points, I don't know if now you say they would typically improve 8 points because they get a situation where they can go back to Lasix. I just don't know. There are smarter people out there like Paul, you know, like some of the database guys like Tony Joe that'll figure this out long before I do. So, I'll just wait until somebody tweets about it or has more concrete evidence about it. But all I know to do is just bet the horses off the figures I've got in front of me and off the projected paces and trips and just let some of this other stuff go because you just don't know.
Right. It's a rabbit hole for sure. But you make a good point. We're going to have so much more data. We probably already have some decent data. For me, I guess what I'd be interested in is looking at the figures. And this is something you and I have talked about before in terms of how to evaluate various stats in racing. You know, win percentage, impact value, ROI. That's all fine and good. And they're interesting little, you know, points of signal potentially. But I want to see when we can look in aggregate at figure improvement or lack thereof on and off Lasix. I mean, we're going to have some great data in, if we don't already, in a couple of months. Yes. Do you think that's right?
Absolutely. I mean, we should have great data. Yeah. It should be very interesting. It'd be nice if, you know, as JK likes to say, in a civilized country where they keep even better record of, you know, horses bleeding and when they bleed and what's done to help them after they bleed. It'd be nice if we had some better veterinary records to go along with some of this stuff. But, you know, that's a pipe dream. We'll just have to rely on tweets from trainers and bloodstock agents to make horses bleed and stuff like that. But
for more transparency. It's something. I mean, it's something interesting. You know, I don't know if HISA is going to consider that within their purview, but to me, they should, because that's information. You know, I guess we've gone down a deep rabbit hole here, but I think it's an important point. And I'm keeping an open mind about HISA, but the things that I've Horse Racing Integrity and Safety Act, for new people who might not know what I'm talking about, it'll be very interesting to see how they connect their role to the betting side of the sport, because I would love to see them take some ambitious approaches when it comes to things like transparency. And as our man Pat Cummings has written about, the idea of the wagering pools and stuff as well. I mean, integrity is more than just pharmaceuticals in horses when it comes to horse racing. There's a lot of other elements to it.
Absolutely.
Let's move on to the Grade 1 La Troyenne. She Dares the Devil joins an elite group of horses to do the Kentucky Oaks La Troyenne Double and did it in impressive fashion. Looked fantastic in the paddock beforehand, as did Envoûtant, who ended up finishing second. She Dares the Devil looks like she should be a serious player in this division, though in most years, though this year with the two absolute the absolute gorilla at the top of the division in Monomoy Girl, and you know, it depends on how far you want to rank Swiss Skydiver behind her after the slightly disappointing run in the Apple Blossom. But it's a super tough division. Where do you think She Dares the Devil fits in it?
Well, to me, she's right there with those other horses now. I guess you've got to throw Latruska in there too after her last race.
No doubt about it.
It's a very strong division, and it's a pretty interesting division too. I'm a little less likely to call Monomo Gorilla an absolute gorilla against the rest of these. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see this play out as the year goes on.
Time Form had a significant regression, a 10-point regression for She Dares the Devil, which surprised me a little bit just looking at the line here. Again, I'm not sure how far you are along in your figure-making process, but if you were to guess from now, how do you have this figure coming? It was a one, let me double-check this, but I think it was a 111. Yeah, 111 on Time Form, which equates to only a 91 buyer speed figure, not what you expect for older females in a Grade 1.
Yeah, you know, looking at my variant reports for the 2 days, I haven't finalized things yet, but just at a glance, it almost looks like the track was sort of slowing down as the days went on, both days. And it looks like that could be the case right before this She Dares the Devil race. So that may be a tricky figure to do. I'm going to guess that on my figure, she stays about what she did from the Oaklawn race, but I'm not totally sure yet.
There might be a logic to that, right? There was water in the, it's a fast draining track, but there was some water in it from all the rain on Thursday at maybe just simple evaporation, track getting deeper as the day goes on, the day after a big deluge. There aren't too many people other than Mike Maloney I can think of who spent more time watching Churchill races than you, Sean. Is that a trend you've seen before in Churchill, the day after a rain, where it slowed down a bit, perhaps as a result of moisture leaving the surface?
Yeah, I wouldn't call it a trend necessarily, but it's definitely, you know, it's definitely something I see at Churchill and other places. It just, you know, tracks, you know, they're living and breathing things sometimes, and they definitely will change as they dry out and get wet. And, you know, so it just looking at some of these races, it just makes sense that this track was slowing down a little bit as you go through that card.
I haven't studied it to make full trip notes on it or anything, but I felt like Friday overall was pretty fair. What did you see a bias of any kind on either surface?
I thought it was pretty fair, honestly. I think you could make the case that the rail was a little bad, like the exact one path. But I thought that's such a tricky call, you know, to say the rail itself was dead, but the two path was probably okay. It does happen, but that's a very tricky bias. I'm going to guess it was probably just fair, and the better horses got more outside flow type trips.
Yeah, we'll move on to talk about Derby Day when we get there. But I did think it was interesting. She Dares the Devil. It looked like Giroux was keeping her off the rail on purpose, but Envoûtant spent plenty of time down there and got beaten a length. So it just seemed, and they were, you know, two of the best runners and ended up 1-2. It just felt kind of fair. We'll put in a word about Sinenus, who was my pick, who unfortunately didn't really get a run, bumped at the start, ended up very wide, and I think probably just got lit up from that bump and just didn't show any semblance of her form. You noticed an interesting thing on the wagering on her. Was curious to see if the race is just a total toss out for you as well.
You know, to be honest, I'm having trouble remembering her trip. I had a lot more trouble this year seeing these races because Churchill Downs is kind enough to black out the signal on my television package, and I got to watch the NBC coverage, which is excellent in its own right, but it's not coverage for horse players. It's coverage for fashionistas and, you know, casual fans. I can tell you that Larry Colmus has a hell of a routine with flashcards to get ready for these races. I saw that at least seven times over the weekend.
You're killing me here.
In terms of watching races, it makes it more difficult, and it makes it, you know, very frustrating that they black out their core customers. But that's neither here nor there, I guess. So, I honestly don't remember Sinenus's trip all that well. I know she didn't run, but I don't know why.
And what was the note on the betting that you passed along to me? There was a big last flash move there, wasn't there?
Yeah, I forget exactly. I mean, I want to say she went from 20-1 to 13-1, maybe something like that.
Amazing. I guess that is proof. I guess that is proof that that late money is not always predicated on one who's broken well, as I've sometimes implied that I've seen. I swear I've seen that happen, but this was not an instance of that. Hopefully, she'll get to show her form another day. Dunbar Road took a ton of money in here. I wasn't wild about her going in. She feels like one who's just, you know, tends to go in and out of form. I've been lucky to be kind of in tune with her, but I think she's in a tough division and it's going to probably have to be handled a little bit carefully. Does that sound fair?
Absolutely. She just seems, you know, she does seem to go in and out of form. And when she's even in form, she seems a cut below the best of this division. So I'm not exactly sure what you do with her going forward.
Let's go forward ourselves here, moving on to the Eight Bells, which was the big win of the day for people who listened to the Pro Players podcast, Paul Matisse made a very compelling case for Obligatory, who ends up getting the job done at 16-1. I think it must be said, though, for me, Day Out of the Office was the one you want out of here. Just sort of, I mean, I'm not criticizing the ride. I think it was just circumstance, but ends up making a very aggressive move into that very fast half-coded red on time form to both the quarter and the half. Just gets taken down late by Obligatory, who gets the absolutely perfect trip right down the center. Those of us who had Obligatory weren't complaining, but Day Out of the Office, that was a serious return and one who's got some valuable prizes beside her name before the end of the year, in my opinion.
I completely agree. She ran huge, I thought. Much the best of the speed, fast pace. She just ran tremendous. And that was a tremendous call by Paul, too, on Obligatory. That was a great, great tip he gave everybody.
Worked out very nicely. This is a good use of the you'd think Timeform US were a sponsor as much as I mentioned them, but it's just notable to me that on their figures to me matches the way I see this race perfectly, with Day Out of the Office getting upgraded for attacking that pace to a 1:14 final figure, with Obligatory getting a 1:10. I feel like that's exactly right for me and how I'm going to evaluate the ability of these two going forward. Do you think I'm underrating Obligatory, or are you in agreement with that?
No, I think that makes sense. Obligatory got to take advantage of a really good situation. No, I think that's probably exactly right.
One interesting thing about horses like Obligatory, and I'm putting you on the spot here, but one thing that I've noticed from talking to you is I used to reflexively downgrade any horse like Obligatory that got that absolutely perfect setup. And I would leave it at that. If it was a Jake Jacobs Racing Flow numbers said it was closer friendly and a closer like Obligatory one, I was pretty much opposing them the next time out. And you did help me see things more through that lens of late pace. And sometimes there are horses who get that kind of setup, but they still finish so fast that they shouldn't be downgraded. Do you have any idea in terms of a late pace figure how Obligatory looks in that regard?
You know, unfortunately, I don't. I haven't done that figure yet. But the basic premise, in my opinion, you're talking about is correct, because it's, I'm not sure this will be the case with Obligatory, but some horses will get a quote setup like that, and they'll still improve the way that I'm looking for them to improve, meaning they've, you know, sometimes they'll make that run into a fast pace a little too early and bump up their own personal pace figures to a point where, combined with a good late pace figure, it shows that they're also an improving horse. So, you know, horses can get setups and still be getting better. So when they come back, it's just sort of foolish to automatically say, well, this horse got a setup last time, he can't run today, depending on what their odds are. You know, if Obligatory comes back and is it even money, you don't want to bet a horse off a great setup at even money. If he's 10 to, or she's 10 to 1 in a spot where nobody believes her because of the good setup, she might be worth a bet.
I think that's extremely well described. Let's talk about the turf sprint. We had Fast Boat getting the job done in this one for Joe Sharp. Coded fast throughout, comes from way back to earn the 1:15 time form figure. Classy John, actually, interestingly, ends up coming out best on their numbers, who only ran third for once again attending that hot pace. A little bit disappointment potentially from Diamond Oops, though there was a meaningful spot of trouble in there. You know, typical turf sprint. There was a lot of chaotic things going on. Curious if you had an opinion about this one.
I really don't. I mean, I think, you know, on my figures, the best horses ran where they should have, and there were some trips in there. Just your typical turf sprint with a pretty solid pace and a wild finish, and Just, you know, there's, I don't think there was much to be gleaned from this race going forward.
I was so mad about myself for a minute when it looked like Sambaye might win, the old last horse I threw out there, especially after needing Sambaye so badly the last day. That was the kind of thing that the horse racing gods will do to you once in a while. I suppose we can talk about the turf rail for a minute. On the Pro Player show, we had speculated that it might not be good, but it didn't look bad at all to me. I mean, it seemed like there was no evidence of it being a bad turf rail that I saw on Friday. It seemed like, for whatever reason, this time around on the new ground with the rain, two things that can lead to it being not great down there, it seemed absolutely fine and fair to me. What did you think of how the turf specifically was playing?
I completely agree. I thought it was just a completely fair turf course. You can just do whatever you wanted to.
Let's talk about the Kentucky Oaks, or a race that, not unlike the Kentucky Derby, was maybe a little bit changed at its outset with some meaningful trouble for one of the key players. But we'll get to that. First of all, we should give our props to Malathot, who gets the job done, did appear to improve significantly. Took a little bit of a bump at the start, was wide on both turns, showed tremendous courage. Figure came back light, and this was what we were talking about before, 116 on time form, and I think it was just the same, 95 on Bayer. But when you factor in how wide Malathot was, the little bit of trouble at the start, I really think this was a legitimate grade one effort, no matter what the speed figure says. What did you think of Malathot? I know you were a big fan heading into the race.
Yeah, I think she ran really well. And she... You know, like you said, she didn't break that great, but Johnny did a great job realizing she needed to be up in this race and sort of center a little bit to get position. And that was, to me, the difference of her winning and losing. I mean, he did that was a tremendous ride to take a horse that's, you know, seemingly fairly grindy and more of a finisher, and to ask her immediately out of the gate like that after having some trouble and putting her in the right spot was, you know, just very, very well done.
It was a great weekend for him, and nowhere more to me were his skills on evidence than in this spot. Search Results ran a very big race, really ran too well not to lose, even, you know, right up behind the pace set by Travel Column, and another one who looked very good, but I feel like evaluating the top finishers in this race coming back, I'm not seeing a particular reason for any of them to reverse form with Malathot.
No, you know, because she sort of took the worst of it and beat them again on the square. So I think you're right. She's clearly the class of this group.
I feel like she has a big figure win to come when things actually go her way, as opposed to the last three starts when at various stages I would have sold my bet to you in race. You know, I mean, I feel like that happened in here, just very, she recovered very quickly, like you said, but like after the break, if you said, do you want to give your Malathot bet back for free? I would have said, yes, please. And certainly in the Ashland, she looked beat, and then forget about the demoiselle. I mean, she had absolutely no chance. So things are going to line up, and I think she's going to run a really big figure. Some rumors floating around, Sean, that this one by Curlin, Out of Dreaming of Julia by AP Indy, might think about the Belmont next time out. What do you think of that notion?
That's not the craziest thing I've ever heard. I mean, I don't think the boys are all that great. So, you know, why not? Pletcher's done it before.
I mean, when I was looking at it at first, I was thinking that on speed figures, it would be a stretch just because the Derby came back so much faster than the Oaks. But as I'm talking it through with you and making that point about Malathot never getting a great trip and still winning, I mean, maybe she'd be able to. I would think that if Essential Quality skips the Preakness and points straight to the Belmont, we'll talk about this when we get there, but I mean, I thought he was best in the Derby, and, you know, famously, as has been picked up everywhere in media, but I think first said on JK+1, Cox has thought he was a Belmont horse from day one. I think he'd be awfully tough to beat, but she'd be very interesting to run in the number. It might be ironic too to have a filly by Curlin in a deep stretch duel in the Belmont with a well fancied runner. It could be very entertaining.
It would be. That'd be a great race.
Let's talk about some of these others coming out of here. You were a big Will's Secret fan. He did not disappoint. Ends up getting that third. Not by a whole lot. What were your emotions like rooting her through it in the stretch? And were you able to capitalize on that very good opinion you gave out?
Well, my thoughts were, I know I didn't have Clairière anywhere, so my thoughts were, run third, damn it. I mean, that was my thought. I couldn't take her fourth at that point because I didn't have Clairière in my supers. So it was a very good result for me. And I thought she got a really good trip, showed a little more tactical speed than she had in some of those races, which was one reason I liked her. I thought she could get that spot. So I, going down the backside, I was very excited, and I was fortunate to cash a pretty good ticket there.
Were you better off with her third, or did you have a lot with her first and second as well? Or was she more of a, really key around her hitting the board kind of thing?
No, I was better off with her third. I mean, second probably would have been better, but I mean, she wasn't getting second. So I used her a little bit on top, but I really liked Malathot. So I didn't, in my vertical plays, I didn't back her up a ton. So I just played, I singled Malathot on top and 80% of my money, and Will's Secret probably was third and fourth and 80% of my money. So it worked out exactly the way I needed it to.
That's fantastic. I'm glad to hear that. Will's Secret might be the one, and you'll tell me when we talk about a race later in the year after all the figures are in, but she feels like the one who might be the beneficiary if one of these big grade ones, they just go too darn fast, and maybe she could be the one to be finishing best late and be able to get ahead of ones who are at least in theory a bit faster than her. Do you think she has that kind of ceiling?
Yeah, I think under the right circumstances, she could snag a grade one. Yeah. She's probably, she's not as good as some of these others, but given the right scenario, absolutely.
And of course, Dallas Stewart, once again, big Triple Crown day, getting the money underneath. JK told that embarrassing story where I tried to make a joke that fell flat when we ran into Dallas Stewart on the streets of Saratoga. And I said, it was funnier at the time, at least in my brain, but I said something like, there's the man you want if you want to, run second in a big grade one. JK told that story to embarrass me, but he didn't tell Dallas's response where he put me in my place and said, well, what do you know? You're the second best analyst on your own podcast.
That's a pretty good line.
Yeah, you don't get one over on Dallas Stewart too often. Yeah, and he showed his quality once again. Okay, we haven't talked about it yet, but the filly in this race who probably got the most discussion before, during, and after, past the champagne. What was your read on? I have strong thoughts, but we'll let you kick this one off, Sean. What did you think about Past the Champagne's trip in the Kentucky Oaks? Did the Donner Party have a better trip?
Yeah, they may not have had a better trip, but it wasn't. It was tight. She was eliminated 50 yards into the race. I felt sort of sick to my stomach, because we're all very close with Jake and Maddie, and they just, they had a live horse and she had no chance after the break. So it made me feel terrible for them. It's a complete throwout race, in my opinion. And afterwards, we all sort of met up after the races that night, and just in talking with them, they were disappointed in that they didn't feel like they learned anything about their filly. And, I sort of said, look, you did learn some things. You learned you had no chance in this race. I mean, she was completely eliminated. You learned that you were a nose away from beating the Oaks winner, and you beat the third place horse in the Oaks by 3 or 4 lengths last time.
Yep.
They met. So, they learned that they've got a very good filly who can compete with these horses, in my opinion, because after she, when she broke bad, it was Javier riding her, right?
It was.
Yeah. And you know, this is Javier's a tremendous rider, but he did the exact opposite of what Johnny did on Malathot. You know, they both broke a beat slow and Johnny sent to get out of trouble and Javier didn't. And he got into more trouble and it was total elimination trouble. So you just, you know, you just throw that race out. She's not going to run from back there. And as far as going forward, she can compete with these horses and she's very, very good.
That's a great point about the form boost, you know, which of course I'd noticed, but yeah, I was thinking the same thing too. Like it's a little bit vexing to not get to know how you stand up, but really we're form analysts. And when the one, the one that you almost just beat wins and the one that you beat pretty handily runs third, you know, you're good. And there'll be another day for Pass the Champagne down the line. I don't know whether I did not ask, but you know, you'd think, she might belong in a race like the Acorn. And maybe if Malathot goes on to a different path, that wouldn't be an unwelcome development for Pass the Champagne or any of the others in this division. Any other thoughts on the Oaks or Oaks Day before we move things along to Saturday's action?
No, I think that pretty much sums it up to me.
All right, let's talk about Saturday. Heading into race number 6, the Distaff Turf Mile, had you noticed anything about how the track was playing?
You know, again, it you could make the case that it could have been a little outside favoring, or you know, middle paths favoring. I'm still not totally sure how the track was playing, but I think for the most part, you could just call it a fair track, and the turf was certainly fair.
That we started off on the turf with Blowout in the Distaff Turf Mile, who I mean, almost couldn't. I mean, to me, was always going to get this trip on paper. And I was actually surprised in the end, as pace conscious as the market is these days, that she wasn't shorter than the 9-5. But there was a lot of market support for Zofel and for Got Stormy. I thought this was a terrific ride by Pratt. It's the opposite of what we always complain about, right? This was not waiting on horses. This was putting the sword to them, opening up by 8. Maintaining that lead by 5. I did think for a moment there we might get swamped late, but he'd saved enough to push her out a half-length winner and get the money. To me, Pratt was the story of the race. What did you think?
You know, I think it was a great ride. You know, I think she really benefited from Jakarta scratching. I think it was Jakarta. There was another possible pace presence in there.
Yep.
And when that happened, you know, he did the exact right thing. Just go the lead and make them come get you. And, you know, I was iffy about her ability to hold these horses off with another pace presence in there. But once that wasn't a factor, she was just as likely to win this race as anybody. And she really showed some guts in the stretch when they came for her. So she might be a little bit better than I gave her credit for.
I guess the market did really come for her, right? I mean, 9-5, she did end up going off the favorite. So those pace considerations did show themselves, because you'd think on form that Got Stormy and maybe Zofel, who was a nose from her last time, would have taken more of the market. So maybe 9-5 was exactly always what the price was going to be, but it ended up being profitable for the folks following along on the At the Races stuff I was doing. Ended up being an okay day on there for sure. But yeah, got things started off with Blowout on Derby Day. Then it was time for the Derby City Distaff Gamin at 1-5. And you talked before about looking for any hole in the armor when you're dealing with a 1-5 shot, and how for you, Aunt Pearl didn't check all the boxes. Coming into this race, did Gamin check all the boxes for you?
Not all the boxes, but you know, most of the boxes. I think we talked about on the Pro Players show that I had sort of a declining form note on her just based off her figures, but that's just sort of, you know, coming off of such a high figure in the Breeders' Cup, she almost could do nothing but decline to some extent. So I was just a little against her, and I used some money against her in the picks just because, you know, like we talked about on that show, if you were to beat her, you were really going to get paid. And it was just a gamble, really, that made sense. And coming out of the race, I'm not convinced my note wasn't correct. I wasn't super impressed with her Saturday. I think she was in a spot where she could have declined a little bit and still won. And I'm not so sure that's not what happened.
I agree with you. Looking at the time form stuff, coded blue throughout, so slow fractions, which it's one of those things where you can, with a filly like Amin, you could, I suppose, make the case, well, it was so slow early, she wasn't going to run her really big final. She's best when she's just going evenly fast throughout. But the fact that the figure came back a lot more like the decline race that you mentioned, the race at Santa. Oh, no, excuse me. What was her last race? My brain is freezing on me here.
It was Santa Anita.
Yeah. And not like the stellar, you know, just looking at time form, the figure line goes 133 in the filly and mare sprint, then 112 in the Santa Anita race, and then 114 for the race on the undercard. And that's what it looked like visually. Did not look like a beast who's going to be able to necessarily boss this division the way that she has in the past. I still think she's going to be a heavy favorite where she shows up next based on name value and all the rest, but maybe one to try to take on at a short price the next time.
Yes, she could be. I'm interested to see how her pace line looks coming out of this race. She wasn't impressive visually at all.
I'll be very curious to see. Do you have any early indication from glancing at your variant report as to what the line is going to look like on her?
Yeah, I think it's going to look okay, but maybe not tremendous. So I'm guessing she's not going to decline again. Certainly,
it really should look okay, though, right? I mean, when you go as slow as she did early, like you're supposed to put up a stellar late pace number, aren't you?
You're supposed to, absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely. And the thing with her is she was putting up some stellar ones when she was going really fast early too. So that's just going to be one of those little, it's definitely going to be a better race than the Santa Anita race. I don't know if it's going to be representative of what she was last year. I'm almost certain it won't be representative of what she was last year.
Next up is the Pass Day Mile, the Grade 2, going a mile, no doubt. Race 8 from Saturday. Jackie's Warrior makes this return to distances of a mile or shorter. A winning one does so in fractions that Travis Stone said in the call, and I agreed, were almost unbelievable with the 43.68 registering for the half mile. It didn't matter. Jackie's Warrior kept on, repelled the challenge of Dream Shake late. I thought this was an awesome performance. It was one that I was expecting to run extremely well. Comes back a 124. This is a really interesting one. 124 on the adjusted time form rating, but only a 115 raw, which would equate to about a 95 buyer, improving to a 104 buyer, to tell you how much of an upgrade time form is giving Jackie's Warrior for the pace setup there. I thought the top two were just very, very good. I'm super excited to see this division as it continues to go forward.
And I'm going to be the one person in the world that's not that impressed with this race.
Tell us. This is why you're here.
Well, and this is going to be, that race, if you just look at the pace of the race in terms of raw time and pace figures, it's very fast. But to really get a feel for, I just call everything pace, but I guess I need to differentiate between pace, meaning early pace, and, race flow, maybe you could call it. I know Jake calls race flow, but he doesn't mean what I'm about to talk about. To me, the shape of this race going into the race, and the flow of the race during the race really benefited Jackie's Warrior, because there was nothing in this race that could finish at all. So going faster wasn't a hindrance for him. That was a benefit. And they crawled home in here. And I've just seen time after time over the years that those horses don't need to be upgraded. I'm going to downgrade him coming out of this race, depending on what the next race looks like pace-wise and flow-wise. You know, if he catches another field where, you know, he's up against, you know, horses that can not put much pressure on them early and don't have any finish, and it just looks like a kind of race where they're going to run all the way around there in order like this, then sure, I'll bet him maybe. But he's going to be grossly overbet because people think he was up against it. And in my mind, he got exactly what he needed to win this race, and Dreamshake got exactly what he needed to run second. So those horses are bets against, in my mind.
To your point,
I don't know if I explained that well, but
no, you explained it perfectly. We'll talk about it a little bit more to make sure to fill in the gaps for people. But I mean, to me, to your point about the flow of the race, I think, you know, Jake Jacobs came up with figures to measure the sort of concept of, does it set up, you know, he's looking at the mathematical underpinnings of what mathematical relationship between the fractions is going to favor a front runner or favor a closer. Before we had stats, we measured race flow by looking at the chart. And the gimmick that you would use is, who was 1, 2, 3 early? Where did they finish late? And this is still often very, very useful in turf races, races where you're not sure about the accuracy of the timings. Just in general, I still think old school race flow is actually an underrated tool. It can, because it can also bake in, you know, Jake can mathematically bake in track bias, but it's just another data point that tries to bake in a lot of different things. And so to that point, to pretend there's no clocks in the world. The horses that were 1, 2, 3 early finished 1, 2, 6. You know, you might get a little bit of a glimmer of exactly what you're saying, Sean. And then the other example that pops to my mind when you're talking about this idea that when you don't have closers who are excellent in terms of their ability to finish their races, that it just becomes a speed of the speed scenario. And there's no better example of that and a horse who's extremely famous in podcast lore for, you know, we talk sometimes about horses kicking or trainers kicking sand in our face. This was a horse that dug a 6 feet hole and threw JK in the bottom of it and then filled it back up with sand. The great Serengeti Empress, pretty darn good example. Historically, of the exact kind of thing you're talking about. If we go back to trying to remember which race it was last year, was it the Ballerina where she got that grade one, that elusive second grade one win and took care of JK?
Yeah, that's the exact example, you know, that I would use. She was a one trick pony and she was very good at that one trick. But when she got a situation that didn't benefit, you know, that where she couldn't use that trick, where there was actual finishers in there against her, she would get drilled. And, you know, another example that happened recently was Nashville. You know, Nashville was brilliantly, you know, fast, didn't finish worth a damn. And when he finally caught up to a horse that could get him on the turn out at Santa Anita, you know, he got drilled and ran out of the number. Those horses are just very susceptible to pace scenarios, and they need something to go exactly their way. And in my mind, Jackie's Warrior got that on Saturday.
It's interesting. Here's another thing. I'm not backing off my opinion that I like the race, but to your point, this is a division that will now start to have the Derby Dreamers coming back to it.
Exactly.
So, you know, whether it's Highly Motivated cutting back, Crowded Trade cutting back, who else leaps to your mind as a good of the Derby crew of the finishers? Because those horses will then have potentially the double benefit of maybe having the right closing running style anyway, and then the added fitness edge of having gone longer, the old turn back angle. Any in particular appeal to you from this point as that King's Bishop future? Oh, excuse me, H. Allen Jerkins future horse.
You know, it's tricky because sort of like what we talked about with the Derby was that way too. You know, the Derby had a very similar pace scenario. We talked about there were two horses in that race that had even close to a Derby, quote, late pace figure. They were Known Agenda and Bourbonic, and they had only done it once a piece and hadn't really proven that they could do it, and, you know, had in scenarios like that, when you just need one horse not to fire, you get these merry-go-round kind of races. And the Derby played out that way. I mean, they made the lead. They just waltzed around there, basically. So it's hard to project, you know, Derby also rans that are gonna be a factor. It's just, you know, to me, you need to, the most important data point is always the race that you're handicapping and what that pace scenario of that exact race brings to the table. And, you know, it's great to sit here and talk about, well, you know, you can upgrade Jackie's Warrior off that race because it was, you know, it didn't benefit him and so, but it doesn't, all that takes a backseat to what race you're looking at today. And you've got to be flexible enough to say, you know, today's scenario isn't last time's scenario, even though I so badly want to bet this horse based off what happened last time.
That's really, really good. Yeah.
You've got to let the odds dictate that too. You know, I got in trouble in the obligatory race that we just talked about a while back because I sort of got wedded to that Caramel Swirl horse, and I bet that race saying that both of them had to do something. And in hindsight, you know, Caramel Swirl wasn't going to get the same scenario she got when she ran so huge at Keeneland. And that was a huge mistake because that race, you could have really, it made a lot of sense under obligatory and you could have really scored there. And I just messed it up getting wedded to that idea of, well, I want to bet this horse. But today's pace scenario, in my opinion, trumps any stat you see, any, you know, improving or declining form thing you come up with, or any horse you want to upgrade off last race. It's got to suit today's race first.
I love what you're saying, and it's really become, and probably largely out of conversations with you, but I think also the fact that you and I both are huge Tom Brohammer fans. And I think actually when I reread Modern Pace Handicapping for the first time in a decade, it was when you lent it to me 5 years ago. And it's really shaped my way of looking at the world now. And it really comes down to, I'd describe it as trying to figure out the internal pace matchups. And that's why you always hear me in an open race wanting to have, you know, the horse that I have with the best early, the horse I have who's the best late. Because when you don't know, I want to, in my picks, try to account for all scenarios, but the best opportunities to score are when you can see that stuff clearly and really drill down and key around horses. And at the same time, fade those horses that aren't going to get the setup. I mean, you know, you go, I feel like you don't do very well in this game betting on the third best speed and the third best closer.
That's exactly right. Exactly.
And those horses will often get bet for other reasons having nothing to do with your key point in this conversation, what today's pace scenario is.
Right.
Well, that's good stuff. I might have to go back and write some of that down for future use somewhere, Sean, because I don't think we've ever spoken about it on these airwaves as clearly as we just did there. Let's talk about the Grade 2 American 3-year-olds on the turf. Oh my goodness gracious. Poor JK. He's got to give his silver wig back here because he nor I were smart enough to throw DuJour in for a penny. I'm tempted to give Flavian Pratt a lot of credit in this spot. it seemed like a tricky pace scenario. Timeform had it coded, read throughout, and in the end, Win From Within was very good attacking, and I thought for a second we might be able to get home there. That would have been an acceptable result for all my picks, but DuJour gets the job done. Were you as shocked as we were on this one?
Shocked isn't the right word. I was surprised the horse ran as well as it did. I'd used it on some backup tickets, so it didn't obliterate my picks or anything, but it combined with the fact that I had pressed the hell out of Lucky Law at a big number, it really hurt to see him winning.
You saw this race way better than I did. What was your use of DuJour? Was it connections related? Like what did you see in this one?
It was just a race where I didn't have a strong opinion, and I just thought it was sort of a spread race. He wasn't that far off some of these others in terms of ability. So I just tossed him in. I had probably 10 times the number of, pick six tickets with Lucky Law pressed at a much bigger price. So it was maybe the worst scenario for me to run second like that. But, Baffert is just a good horse trainer. And I know he's not a turf trainer, but he can win turf races under the right scenarios. And he got it Saturday. The horse got a great trip and it was a great ride.
I feel like Win From Within is a horse who's going to win some valuable prizes. That speed, such a valuable weapon. He appears to continue to be improving. I'll have him as a flow move up coming out of this, attacking the fast pace. Everything for me going forward makes me want to win From Within with this group. How about you? Anybody you're excited to bet next time? I feel like you're Lucky Law. This was the day you were supposed to have Lucky Law and you just got unlucky.
Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah, I guess Win From Within is probably the one you want out of here. He ran a pretty good race.
Not exactly sure what happened to, I gave a lot of credit to that Annex, those Annex Scarlet Sky form lines, and neither one was able to land anything resembling a blow. Scarlet Sky, not shockingly, had kind of a rough trip from out there in the 13, but it just looked like Annex just didn't look to run a very good race.
Yeah, I agree. This was another race that I didn't see that well, but he didn't appear to run a step to me, so I wouldn't want any part of him next time.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. I mean, this group, the 3-year-olds, they're evolving. I liked where my goofy long shot in here was Royal Prince, who I felt like ran half a race before spitting it. Be interesting to see where they turn up. We'll talk much more about these horses when they come back. Let's get back to the Grade One action in the Churchill Downs. Another race I thought that featured. I think it featured a great ride because I'm assuming everything that happened was conscious. It was a very weird looking ride by the winner, Flagstaff, Luis Saez aboard Flagstaff, who ends up being there, taken back, coming again, looking beat, surging again late. Another race that was coded red throughout on Timeform US. A very nice winner to just get the head victory over Lexitonian, a horse that would have been a sickener for me. As many times as I backed Lexitonian, nearly gets there at 46-1. Whitmore ranged up, looked like winning, and just had to settle for third. But I mean, I came out of the race with even more respect for Whitmore than I had before. I mean, he's just such a hard trying sort. And as I said over on attheraces.com, I feel like if you don't like Whitmore, you don't like racing. I could have dealt with him kicking the sand in my face. What did you think of the Churchill Downs?
It was just a remarkable race. And I felt, I didn't have Lexingtonian on a ticket. So I felt very lucky to just be alive leaving this thing. But I agree. I mean, Flagstaff just had a very strange race. And
how much of it was by design, do you think?
I don't know, honestly.
I'm wanting to give credit, but it could be something crazy just worked out.
I would lean in that direction more than by design. But
you're more cynical than me, though. So that's a
Right. Well, you know, when you try to get in the heads of jockeys sometimes and figure out if they were really trying to do what happened, it's just it's foolish. So who knows? But, I was super impressed with Flagstaff, the way he just seemed so gutty in the stretch. I wasn't sure he had that in him. And then what you said about Whitmore, I mean, how could you not love that horse? He just fires every time. He's an old man at this point, and he's just always around, and he's just fun to watch from a fan perspective.
It was a tough day for JK. Pratt, who he always knocks, to me looked, to prove beyond a doubt that he's among the very best in his profession in any jock's room in North America. And Whitmore, who he always knocks, makes a good accounting of himself. And then the real problem happens, of course, in a race we'll be talking about in two races time. But he, I don't know if you talked to him during the day, he must have been disconsolate at some point.
He takes things in stride pretty well, though. He's not to mention on the local Lexington airwaves, he got beat up a little bit here too
I want to hear more about that. I'm sure that Kentucky Sports Radio is available online, but I'm not in the habit of listening. People weren't too impressed with his opinion on Ant Pearl.
Well, he gives out horses as can't lose, and then they run up the track, and then he's doesn't look so hot, but it happens.
Probably the right take. He basically never says that on our airwaves, but I mean it must just be a case of him knowing the audience. I would think if you go on KSR with Matt Jones and you don't give a strong opinion, you just sound wishy washy, right? It's like the same reason we don't come on here really and equivocate that much. About, I like horse X at this price, horse Y at this price, horse C at this price. That doesn't really play with our crowd. We've got to give opinions, and then we can start equivocating. But maybe it's the same deal. He feels like he has to do this ridiculous can't lose thing, which of course he knows is, not the reality of the situation.
Yeah. He painted himself in the corner last fall when he said he'd retire from touting if She Dares the Devil wins the Oak.
When she comes back and wins the La Troyenne, does that mean he can come out of retirement? How does that work?
Yeah, I don't know. It's a funny thing. I learned long ago that you just don't make statements like that, certainly in public. Because I think I've told you the story of I talked my mom off of betting Mind That Bird on Derby Day. By saying, if that horse wins, I'm not betting ever again.
Oh my God, that's fantastic. You've definitely never told me that story because I would not have forgotten it. Yeah. That is amazing. How long did your retirement last?
Well, I mean, they had a 13th race that day, Pete, so I certainly didn't stop betting. But
I thought maybe at least it was until the Wednesday carryover came out.
No, you just can't. You can't make statements like that to certainly in public. You can't.
Sports radio, though, it's a different world. It's much closer to. I think it's much closer to pro wrestling, where one of the things I've always admired about professional wrestling is the overweening confidence of the heel. You know what I mean? Like that guy, he's pretty much going to have to do jobs at a lot of pay-per-views and put the big baby face over at the big local show. But he's going to be right back on the show the next day, just as confident that he's the best. And I think that's kind of how you have to be in sports radio.
Oh, absolutely. You go out there, you do your job, you get beat, and then you lie and say you never got beat.
When everybody knows it's the heel who's really, doing all the hard work anyway and makes the show go. So they have that. They have that in the back of their mind. Without them, the babyface has nobody to look good against. Sorry. Enough wrestling. Enough Kentucky Sports Radio. Let's talk about the Grade One Turf Classic. Oh my goodness, this was a great race. It was so super exciting. In the end, it would have been a darn shame if either Colonel Liam or Domestic Spending had to lose. Neither one did. This race came back nice, I thought, because you've got a fast figure, right? 124 on the time form scale for the winner, Colonel Liam, 125 for the other winner, Domestic Spending. But this was not a race that was run at a fast gallop throughout. And to me, that maybe gives cause to upgrade. Can't wait to hear when you've got actual late pace figures. But this was, I'm pretty sure, going to be a race almost has to be a race, as the Batiste brothers describe, uplining, where they were going faster at the end. I think these are serious horses, and it's going to be fun watching them tangle. And Smooth Like Straight, yeah, he had an advantage and maybe isn't going to be one that I'm going to be supporting against the two that beat him that day. But as a horse who I think can go out there to California and wreak some havoc out in that turf division, I really like the top three in this race. What did you think of it?
It was a great horse race. You know, I think it was definitely one of those upline pace scenarios where they went slow early and fast late. And that suited both of those horses because they're both tremendous finishers. I needed Domestic Spending to win outright, but it you know, I'll take what I get. And that, it was a great horse race. I do think Domestic Spending was best, you know, having just a spot of trouble as they spun into the lane, and he had to hold off on his run just a beat or two longer than Colonel Liam and came flying. But it was a great race.
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't know all that goes into the algorithm why Domestic Spending got the extra point on the time form scale for this one. Maybe because the algorithm must upgrade when it's a slow pace, the horse who had to come from farther back, which he certainly did. That's obviously why it is, now that I think about it for a second, post fail. But yeah, Domestic Spending, and we know how excited Connections were about him heading into the race. I think he is certainly one in his first race of the year. I mean, you made the point about why he might have been better in race. He's also moving forward, clearly, whereas Colonel Liam now with, what, four starts on the year, I mean, it wouldn't be crazy to suggest that. I mean, who knows? He could continue to improve as a four-year-old, and maybe he continues to get better. But I think there's a big case to be made that Colonel Liam is awesome, and this is how awesome he is, and that Domestic Spending could be a contender for a race like, you know, the biggest turf prizes in America, depending on how far he wants to run. What do you think?
No, I think that's exactly right. Domestic Spending is the one I want out of here moving forward. I think we just sort of know what Colonel Liam is, and I don't expect him to improve much from this level. But Domestic Spending looks to me like he could jump forward again.
Yeah, I mean, you'd think on pedigree that you know, Breeders' Cup, I mean, it could be a, I guess, let me pull up his PP cut so I don't embarrass myself here. I'm trying to do this from memory, which never works out very well. If you have his PP cut in front of you, let me know. But I'm curious to see if it could be a bricks and mortar where he ends up between the mile and the turf and they have to decide, or if it's an obvious answer between those two for the choices they're going to make for this horse.
Yeah, I'm not sure. He looks bred to me to keep going longer, but
definitely Street Cry mare by Kingman. And just looking at the form, I mean, was able to win the Saratoga Derby going. Well, that was just, what was that? That was a mile and 3/16. So, I mean, he hasn't done the big stretch out yet, but I mean, he just shapes like it's going to be no problem at all. So I'm excited. I'm sure we'll hear more about him, but I mean that's a super exciting horse. Anything else on that one, or should we turn our attention to the big race?
Let's talk about the big one.
So let's talk about the pace in this race, because I think it's a really interesting race to talk about pace. Time Form actually had the mile coded fast, doing the old school flow thing I talked about earlier. The 1-2-3 early end up, you know, 1-3 and well, Soup and Sandwich ended up last, but whatever, you know, there were various issues with that horse. But I mean, you know, so when you see the 1-3 who are early run 1-2 late, it feels like a slow pace. It felt like a slow pace for a Derby visually. We know the other speed horse didn't break. That's been well covered on the other show. But I mean, in your mind, was this fast, slow, or neutral pace?
Well, I think it was probably neutral. You know, there may have been a spot or two internally that got fast, like Craig's stuff is showing. But, you know, to me, it was just sort of one of those scenarios like we just talked about, where even if it does come back a little fast, it was just a flow that benefited front runners because there just wasn't much behind there to do any running. And the ones that that could do some running. You know, I think Known Agenda had a horrendous trip, based on the, you know, and I think it was a jockey error. And then Bourbonic, you know, when he started his run, he sort of ran up behind Known Agenda and immediately had to slam on the brakes. And, you know, a horse like that, that's a one run closer that is just gearing up and has to stop, isn't, you know, he's not going to make any moves. So it was just a scenario that played out to benefit these horses that were up close, in my opinion.
Yeah, that's very valid sounding. We'll talk about the specifics of some of these trips, but let me ask you that what I asked JK about this one. Who in your mind was best in this year's Kentucky Derby?
That's a really hard question.
I feel pretty confident in saying Essential Quality, based on the width of the trip and the start.
Yeah. I guess you could say that. I don't disagree with that really. I don't know how much the width of the trip mattered. That's still one of the things I'm trying to figure out about that track. I mean, it probably mattered a little bit. It's hard to say anybody else just because, you know, Medina Spirit got a perfect trip. Mandaloon got a perfect trip. Charlie basically got a perfect trip. Then you're, you know, talking about sort of also Rands and Obesos and Midnight Bourbon and Keep Me in Mind. So yeah, I guess you have to say Essential Quality, but I'm not fired up to bet him next time.
I think you could make a Medina Spirit case if you believe that the outside paths were an advantage on the day. And if you buy the idea that, you know, the pace heated up enough where he was supposed to be vulnerable to Mandaloon and Hot Rod Charlie and outfinish them. I think it's extremely tough to make a case that it's Mandaloon or Hot Rod Charlie who was best, but I think even with, you know, because I think the ground loss with them is minimal, but the ground loss was enough with Essential Quality that I think it's down to them. Well, where do you stand at this point about how advantageous the outside could have been, and Medina Spirit, was he just enough off the rail, even if the outside was okay, that it didn't really matter? Just curious to dig a little deeper into your thoughts on the track bias or lack thereof.
Yeah, I don't think Medina Spirit really wasn't on the rail. So if the rail was a disadvantage, I don't think it affected him because, you know, they rode him sort of in the 2 and 2.5 path a lot of that trip. I'm leaning to say that it was, you know, one of these strange tracks where being glued to the rail wasn't necessarily a good thing, and being 6 and 7 wide wasn't necessarily a good thing, but being in the middle paths was a slight advantage. But it's tricky to, you know, it's tricky to evaluate horses coming off that track because trips that's a very tricky bias to evaluate.
Some people might think we're nuts, by the way. You know, there are established methodologies within horse racing that the geometry always matters. In other words, they'll think it's always better to be 2 wide than 3 wide, always better to be 3 wide than 4 wide. Whereas, and I'll let you speak about this, at Churchill Downs in particular, that's very often not the case.
Yeah, that's very often not the case at Churchill Downs. So sorry.
That's okay.
I had to let Norman out.
We're used to pet interruptions. That's completely acceptable. We don't mind barking in the background either. Muggsy's been, she's sleeping on the bed over there. She's been very quiet during the show. So Norman has taken Muggsy's role. Perrin actually did interrupt, but I muted her out today. She's been making too many cameos. I'm starting to think she's doing it on purpose. So I wanted to keep that under control. But as far as the Churchill track goes, I mean, I think Mike describes it in the book where there's a lot of days at Churchill where somehow there's no difference between in the 2 path or the being in the rail or the 5 path. Like not even the geometry of it comes into play, which I think might be a very new concept to a lot of people listening.
Yes, there's a lot of days where that's exactly the case, where it's just sort of even all the way around there. And you could say that's sort of an outside bias because negates the geometry. So that's, you know, that's sort of what I'm struggling with the track on Friday and Saturday, is if that was the case or not.
Right. Because if it's that type of 0-1 track, I think Mike calls it in the book, maybe you wouldn't necessarily need to upgrade essential quality. I just felt like between the bumping, between the getting hustled for position and the width of it, I felt like there was enough there to make up the, gosh, how many lengths was it? It wasn't many. I mean,
no, he got beat, what, a length or length and a half, maybe?
Yeah, length and a half. So, I mean, that's why I feel confident in that selection. If it was an inside day, it would be like one of those, who was it? I guess we had a couple of those trips with Tacitus where I'd come back and say, he was much the best.
Yeah.
Never really got to cash the bet based on that opinion. So we'll leave that discussion for another time. But yeah, that it's, for me, I'm even factoring in that not exactly sure about the ground loss. I still feel okay about that opinion.
Yeah, I think he's the one you definitely want. I just don't know. I don't know how much of him I want is my dilemma.
The other one I put up as one to follow with JK yesterday was Keep Me In Mind, who I was impressed for a horse that I felt like did not break well, made a big wide move, and was closing late. Into a race, again, sort of up in the air, though I do have one new piece of information that I didn't have yesterday. Racing Flow had the stuff neutral. Curious to know if you have any sort of projected LP on him or just an opinion about Keep Me In Mind going forward.
You know, I didn't like him at all going into the race. He sort of did. You know, to me, he just clunked up in not a great race. I wouldn't be super excited to bet him coming out of this, you know, no matter what his LP is. I don't think he's that talented. I think Saturday was probably the day to catch him in a betting situation. It didn't work out, but you know, I wouldn't be jazzed up to bet him coming out of that effort because he didn't, you know, he just ran by. My opinion of the race going into it was it wasn't a very good group. And he just ran by some horses that I didn't think were that good. So I wouldn't be real thrilled about coming back to him.
That's reasonable. I'm curious to see. I think he's a very interesting one, depending on how we end up looking at the pace. And I'd love to see if the actual LP were good, I would start to get very interested in him potentially, or if it's just a situation where I think it's going to favor a closer. Let's talk about Midnight Bourbon. Cause there's been a lot of debate. A lot of people have been pillorying Mike Smith for not going forward. But in my view, the early bump, like, you know, it was the old Mike Tyson, everybody has a plan until they get punched in the face. I feel like the horse got punched in the face and he felt maybe like he needed to regather the horse a little bit and then just ended up out of position and you know, didn't do a whole lot of finding. But then again, you could say that, but then again, sixth in the Kentucky Derby isn't exactly a disgraceful run. Was your read on Midnight Bourbon that this was you said before you hate this game, but I'm going to make you play it. Was this a tactical decision or was this the circumstances of the race?
To be totally honest, I don't know. I need to watch the replay on him again. I can pull up right now while we chat if you
want. Yeah, do it. Pull up that replay while we'll talk about a few others. I do want to talk about Known Agenda. I'll give my theory. So, you know, you and I both hated this post for Known Agenda. And it wasn't because of the hoodoo of the historical poorness of the post, because theoretically, at least, the new gate was going to give a horse an opportunity to break and continue to go straight and not run into a fence. Whereas before, you had to do a little do-si-do from the start to be able to get a clean run out of there. It was obviously a hideous disadvantage in previous years that was not the case this year. That being said, still hated it when trying to project the trip that Known Agenda was going to get. As it turned out, he actually broke really, really well. But I think Irad Ortiz consciously made the decision to essentially hold up, let the cavalry charge the first turn happen, and then ride him for luck as the Brits say, as opposed to trying to go forward and aggressively get his position going forward, which I assume he was just afraid to do based on the oncoming cavalry charge of gates 2 through 19. I feel like I'm hesitant to call it a bad ride because I feel like it was a classic damned if you do, damned if you don't. And we knew he was in deep water as soon as we saw the one next to his name. But I think you see it similarly to me, but maybe with a little bit more nuance. What's your evaluation of Known Agenda coming out of this race?
I thought it was a horrendous ride.
Tell us why.
Well, because, you know, you're lucky enough to break like that from the one hole, and then you immediately give that up by not being aggressive with the horse. I mean, he should have been sitting right behind St. Hood on the rail. He broke sharp enough. He was in that position. And then he just gave up. He let the, you know, he's even sending the horse initially, and then he's inside the two and just, you know, he let whoever was on the two dictate what his trip was going to be instead of being aggressive and dictating his own trip. And to me, that's a huge mistake, especially on that particular horse. I don't get tickets anymore in my hand, but I was ripping up my electronic tickets, you know, similar to pass the champagne tickets the day before. That race was over for him out of the gate. And that was a complete error by Irad.
He needed to go forward for you and then maybe try to get outside.
If he's sitting behind St. Hood where he should have been going down the backside, that horse had a legitimate chance to do something in that race. And instead he's got Bourbonic and Keep Me in Mind beat going around the first turn, and he's totally screwed.
Yeah, I mean, you make a compelling case, honestly. I mean, you know, it's very unusual for such a rider who's been riding at such a high pitch too. Be interesting to hear if we get him to talk about it at some point. So I assume just a total line through it, you will evaluate Known Agenda. I mean, is Known Agenda the next of the Pletcher Derby horses to go to the Belmont with a big chance? What do you think happens for him next?
You know, not knowing the figures coming out of this race, I think he actually ran a pretty good race to get what he got. So I'm totally willing to bet him again, you know, depending on price and setup of the race he ends up in. But, you know, he got a terrible scenario Saturday and still did a little bit of running, in my opinion. So, yeah, I'm still interested in him.
Yeah, the 107 time form speed figure is not, I mean, it's not bad. It's not bad at all, really, given everything that developed. I think I mentioned it was a 122 for Medina Spirit, which jibed perfectly with the buyer scale that had it at a 102 and did represent a little bit of a step up. All right, should we go back to Midnight Bourbon now? I think you might have had a chance to rewatch that. What did you think? Was it deliberate or was it circumstance? Mike Smith's tactics.
A little bit of both, I think. I mean, I think it was deliberate after the bump that he didn't really send up in there. But I think the bump, you know, I think that dictated his decision making, and he would have had a difficult task to get any better position after that happened. I mean, there's one opening where he could have really tried to make a hole that was there briefly, but I think just watching it, he was going to get eliminated if he tried to do that. It looks like maybe Dynamic One was coming over right when he could have gone, and that would have sort of compounded things. So I can't totally fault Mike Smith for this. I think this may have just been one of those derby circumstantial situations where the horse got bumped and then got sort of out of position. And, you know, that horse actually ran pretty good.
Well, I'm glad you agree with me about one of the riders I'm apologizing for. So that makes me feel better. It would be fun to do this, you know, on YouTube with the right race where we had the right to do it. We could do this with video, with tape, and roll it back and see exactly what you're talking about. There's an idea for a future show with you and Paul to do it at that granular level. One point I'll make for people who are listening back to the show, I think the show will be decently evergreen, so I don't mind making some of these bigger point tangents. All bumps not created equal, right? I mean, a bump can mean nothing, especially if you're like the horse instigating the bump and you brush your shoulder and you have the momentum and you go on with it. Or a bump can really knock the wind out of a horse and cause a jock to have to ride for a couple of strides to sort of get the horse back under him and get back in rhythm. And I think it's very hard to see from the tape. And sometimes it's obvious that the bump was no big deal, but sometimes that more neutral bump, you can't know what's happened. And I think it's one of the very difficult things about trip handicapping. And of course, in the comment line, all you're going to see is bump. It's not going to give you any of that. So sometimes there's a lot of nuance required in figuring that out in your trip notes. What advice do you have about trip handicappers trying to figure out what a bump meant?
That's very tricky. I think your idea of putting some video to it and talking over it is actually really good, because it means totally different things for different horses. You know, it can be total elimination like it was for Pass the Champagne, or it could just be not much for other horses. And it really matters what the jockey does after the bump, as we just sort of talked about. You know, to really understand what trips mean, you really need to understand the individual talents of the horses. And that's just a very hard thing to do and to explain in a, you know, 45 second podcast hit. You know, it's just, it takes years and years of watching racing and making your own figures and doing stuff like that. Or even if you're not making the figures, just using figures and knowing where horses should be throughout the race and where they end up after trouble, and if they have the ability to overcome what happened to them in the race talent wise. It's a hard thing to explain. It just takes a lot of practice. But I think the general point of a bump is not a bump is correct. Cause it sometimes it means 5 or 6 lengths. Sometimes it doesn't mean half a length.
Right. It's pretty interesting, and it does resist easy explanation. But while we're talking about bumps, got to talk about the elephant in the room, as far as I'm concerned, in this year's Kentucky Derby. We're going to get more information about this as soon as today, because our colleague, Ramon Dominguez, I know, is speaking with Joel Rosario for the Exacta Box podcast. And I can't wait to hear about what happened, but you've probably seen the photo by now. We showed it on the other show. Joel Rosario's iron foot, not in the iron at the break, reducing his control, and then the butterfly flapping its wings in China, causing the landslide in California. A series of events occur, including him getting bumped. To my mind, I'm curious to hear what you would say, but to me, that was past the champagne level of eliminated, and absolutely changing the pace scenario in this year's Derby as a result. What do you think of Rock Your World's performance, or lack thereof, in this year's Derby?
That was a bump that was total elimination. And it was total elimination because that horse didn't have the ability to overcome it based on his talent level and his level of finish in races. I mean, that was a horse that needed a 100% perfect trip to perform. And you get a bump like that on a horse that runs, you know, high 70s to low 80 late pace figures, which is, you know, maidens can do that. He's just screwed. You know, I don't have any idea what happened with his boot and why he was seemingly out of the irons leaving the gate. That's, you know, I'll let Ramon figure that out. I have no idea. But once he got hit like he did and got put, you know, 5 wide down the backside in 12th position, that horse had no chance.
It's been noted that it Rosario, a very streaky rider. I mean, I feel like when he's on his best, there are few, if any, I'd rather have on my side than him. But it didn't seem to be his strongest riding weekend. Easily, in my view, could be put down to randomness. But I was just curious if you noticed anything about his performance over the 2 days.
It wasn't great.
Jackie's Warrior, he did okay on. I suppose.
You know, he's a great rider, but he's also eligible to put in some bad rides. I don't really think Rock Your World was necessarily a bad ride, other than the fact that, you know, I guess you're supposed to have your damn boots in the irons as they're leaving the gate for the Kentucky Derby. I mean, if that was his screw up, then that's a big screw up, obviously. But after he got hit the way he did, I can't fault the ride necessarily. What else was he supposed to do?
Right. There are potential mitigating circumstances, all kinds of rumors going around. Obviously, his version will be through his own eyes. And right. I can't imagine him saying, oh, I wasn't prepared. There has to be some sort of story there.
Yeah.
We'll get it hopefully as soon as later today. Few other runners I want to touch base on with you. We're not going to go through the whole field, but I know you were one of the few who had the Wood as a strong prep. How do you feel about that opinion coming out of the Kentucky Derby? Not willing to fall on the sword just yet?
Well, you know, I don't know. I don't think Bourbonic got his chance to run, really. I mean, a horse like that, like we said, that just gets dead stopped when he's starting his run, that really hurts that horse, whereas some other horses it might not hurt as much. Look, I was never – Bourbonic was the only one out of the Wood that I wanted. I was not a Dynamic One fan just because, you know, he was another one that has proven it. He doesn't have any finish. And, you know, making the move into the fast pace in the Wood didn't do anything for me in the Derby. So it's hard for me to really judge that race just off the Derby. Now – you know, I thought my figures coming out of that Aqueduct prep weekend were higher than most figures. And, you know, I thought search results sort of backed that up to some extent. And, you know, the Wood, it was probably higher because the pace was faster. And the only horse I wanted out of there didn't get a chance to show what he can do. So I don't know. It wasn't a, you know, super strong prep, obviously. But I don't think it was as bad as most people do either.
Here's just a ridiculous theoretical I'll give you. Rock Your World breaks, gets his perfect trip, gets to the front, or at least pressing Medina Spirit. Pretty sure on your pace figures, like the Timeform ones, he was the other horse that you could really put on the lead in the race. Who do you think wins if the Rock Your World trip doesn't happen?
If Rock Your World makes the lead, or if he's pressing,
I think it's too hard to split that atom for me. And I feel like the right move would have probably been for neither one of them to try to give the other an inch and just have a proper pace duel, and then yeah. Whichever one was best is the leader.
God, it's so hard. You know, it just depends on how hard they got into a duel. I mean, if Rock Your World breaks and just sort of settles outside Medina Spirit and they don't go a whole lot faster than they did here, I would say Medina Spirit still probably wins. Just because Rock Your World, you know, he was going to stop on the turn unless he was totally loose on the lead and stuff happened behind him that let him scoot away in the turn. He was going to stop.
You think his only way of winning was to basically get Medina Spirit's exact trip, maybe even a little softer?
Yes. Yes. Right. Because even Medina Spirit, who doesn't finish that well, finished links better than Rock Your World does. So I think he stops regardless. I think if they get into a real duel, I would say probably Hot Rod Charlie, because I think if they got in a real duel and Mandaloon set the trip, he's, you know, if he was still just the same amount of links off Medina Spirit, he would have been too close and he wouldn't have finished. You know, Hot Rod Charlie saving the ground against Elusive or Essential Quality may have won it. One of those two, I think, probably was your winner if there was a real proper duel.
I was curious if you'd bring in any of the deeper closers and Obesos or, you know, I guess you've made your point that you're not a big keep me in mind guy, but I totally take your point. The only thing I'll say this, I've had talked to a lot of people about Hot Rod Charlie. And for me, as close as he was and as good of a race as he ran, he was never winning. But I guess we're talking about changing the pace situation so fundamentally that that could have been the difference, where a horse just kind of, it would have set up for a one-paced horse who was never winning in a slow-paced front runner favoring race to go ahead and get the job done. So interesting stuff. What else? I think we're about wrapped here, Sean. I've kept you a very long time today, but did you have any other thoughts coming out of this year's Derby or on the weekend?
No, not really. I think we covered just about everything I was thinking.
Yeah, we didn't talk about Highly Motivated at all. Feels like an interesting cutback potential runner to me. No idea what the plans are for him, but just like running down the field, that's really the only other thought I have. Everything else looked pretty straightforward, and or we already talked about it. So we're going to get you back on these airwaves soon. Maybe you and Paul for Belmont. Would be fantastic to have you if you want to do another round table. I'll put you on the spot. You up for doing something like that?
Always. I love those.
Excellent. Excellent. And then we have this new concept too of messing around with video for a review show at some point. Who knows? Maybe I'll press you into service and we'll break that out for the Preakness. I just have to call our friends over at NBC and make sure we're not going to, you know, have any lawyers tracking Drew Cotney down. We don't want to do that to the poor guy. All right. We are wrapping. Thank you so much, Sean Borman. Thank you, Norman, for providing some audio accompaniment. You got to let that dog in, I think. What's going on out there?
Yeah, he's very curmudgeonly.
Like his owner. It's only appropriate when you think about it. Thank you also to our founding partners at Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation and 10 Strike Racing. TRF, we've got this new whiskey out. I want folks to check it out. TRFinc.org/players. Thanks also to some new sponsors. Lone Star Park, they're back this week. We're going to have a lot of extra content for them. Canterbury Park, they're back in the fold. Going to have some stuff for them later in the year. You're going to also be hearing a lot more about LTN Global and our Innovation in Racing series. Had so much fun talking to Chris Lush last week about the Dark Horse app up at Woodbine. Go back and listen to that show, folks. If you got busy like many of us did and didn't get to keep up on all the content, we dropped a couple of interesting evergreen shows with Chris Lush and Mark Kramer in the middle of the week. And then we came back for some more Kramer late week in the week before the Derby. So those will be pretty recent in your podcast feed. I don't want them to get lost. I want you to check them out. If you want more information about everything we do, join our newsletter. It's free. Great way to check out all the content in themoneypodcast.com/email. There'll also be some details about our Plus service on there. We're going to have a special Plus podcast. I think it's going to be me and Nick Tamaro tomorrow for the carryover there. Join us for Horse Players Happy Hour as well. That's an important thing to do, supporting charity and lots of added value with 2 Breeders' Cup Betting Challenge seats. That's $20,000 worth of assets added to the prize pool on our Horse Players Happy Hour tour. Go to horseplayers.com, sign up for Horse Players Happy Hour game, and watch us live. You can check that out on our stream over on Twitter. If you follow me, Looms Boldly. If you follow the Breeders' Cup, that's another good way to get that. Most of all, though, I want to thank all of you, the listeners, for making these shows so much fun to do. This show's been a production of In the Money Media. Our business manager is Drew Cotney. Our chief creative officer is Jonathan Kitchen. I'm Peter Thomas Fornital. May you win all your photos!